A Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Hello and welcome back to the Deep Dive. I'm your host, ready to explore another, well, incredible book that really shapes how we see the world.
Great to be here. And yeah, it's particularly excited about today's subject. It's not just about literature, is it? It feels like it's about reality itself.
Absolutely. Today, we're plunging into Eric Auerbach's huge work, Mimesis, The Representation of Reality in Western Literature.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you've ever wondered why some stories feel just incredibly real, almost tangible, and others, well, they deliberately leave you guessing, this deep dive is definitely for you.
Indeed. Auerbach takes us on this amazing journey, like 3 millennia of Western storytelling.
3,000 years.
Yeah, uncovering how the way we represent reality has evolved and, you know, what those changes actually reveal about, well, human consciousness, society, our whole understanding of the world.
It sounds like a massive undertaking.
It is. But by the end, you'll have this new lens, sort of, to view pretty much every narrative you encounter.
It's like getting story X revision. You can see the bones, the structure, the purpose underneath.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, so let's start by meeting the mind behind Mimesis.
Yeah.
Eric Auerbach himself. His story is almost as compelling as the literary history he dissects.
Absolutely. Auerbach, born in Germany, 1892. He was a German-Jewish philologist and a literary critic.
Philology, that's the study of language and historical text, right?
Exactly. So Imagine someone with this like encyclopedic grasp of European literature, everything from ancient Greek epics, you know, right up to the modern novel.
Yeah.
And all steeped in that rigorous German tradition of philology.
But his academic side, brilliant as it was, isn't even the most remarkable part, is it? His backstory is just... Well, it's unique.
It really is. So 1935, under the Nazi regime, Auerbach was forced out of his academic post. He had to flee.
Right.
He found refuge in Istanbul, Turkey. And it was there, between 1942 and 1945, that he wrote Mimesis.
Okay, that context is just crucial. So he's isolated, cut off from Europe's big libraries, his colleagues.
Totally cut off. He wrote Mimesis largely, almost entirely from memory.
Yeah.
Very limited access to the actual texts.
That's incredible.
And this forced isolation, kind of paradoxically, it created the book's signature quality. Mm-hmm. This breathtakingly broad synthetic vision. It spans centuries, connects texts you wouldn't normally think of together.
So he's writing this profound defense, this analysis of Western civilization, literally while that civilization is tearing itself apart in World War II.
Precisely. It's this powerful act of, well, humanism. He's both an insider, you know, deeply educated in these traditions.
And an outsider, watching from Istanbul. That dual perspective must have given him such clarity.
It seems so. A kind of unique detachment, maybe? It let him see the grand patterns, the big picture, where others might have just seen the details.
Okay, so with that incredible backdrop, what's the big story Mimesis actually tells? Let's start with the title, Mimesis, Greek word.
Right, it means imitation or representation of reality.
Okay.
And Auerbach's core argument, his central thesis, is that Western literature has been on this continuous journey, moving towards a more democratic representation of reality.
Democratic? How so?
Well, moving away from what he called the classical separation of styles.
Separation of styles. That sounds pretty rigid. What did that look like in ancient literature?
Think of it like a literary caste system. Really strict rules.
Okay.
Serious, tragic subjects.
Yeah.
You know, gods, kings, epic battles. They were strictly for the high style, grand language, elevated tone.
Right.
But the everyday lives of common people, that was pushed down into the low style. Comedies, maybe satire, nothing serious.
So you wouldn't find like a farmer's personal tragedy treated with the same seriousness as a king's downfall in the same work.
Exactly. The two were kept completely separate. A strict hierarchy.
But something shattered that hierarchy, didn't it? What was the catalyst, according to Auerbach?
He points squarely at the Judeo-Christian tradition. That was the seismic shift, specifically the story of Christ.
How so?
Well, think about it. A divine figure, God, born in the humblest circumstances, a stable. Living among fishermen, commoners, suffering a really degrading public death.
Right, an execution reserved for criminals.
Precisely. This narrative fundamentally fractured that classical separation. It mixed the highest possible subject, the divine, with the lowest stylistic elements, suffering, humility, the everyday.
Ah, I see. So that fusion, the sublime meeting, the mundane, the tragic mixed with the everyday, that's what paved the way for a new kind of realism.
Exactly. It meant that profound spiritual, profound human significance could now be found not just in heroes and kings, but in ordinary life, even in suffering.
So the book traces this.
Yeah, it becomes this archaeology of Western thought, as he puts it, tracing this evolution across nearly 3,000 years, showing how historical shifts, cultural changes, they all found expression in new literary forms and a deeper, more, you know, inclusive understanding of what it means to be human.
And this whole massive journey kicks off with him comparing just two passages, one from Homer, one from the Bible. It's like the foundation.
It really is. He starts with the famous Odysseus's scar scene from the Odyssey.
Oh, yeah, I remember this. The old nurse recognizes him by a scar.
Right. And Homer stops everything, pauses the main story for this long, detailed flashback about exactly how Odysseus got that scar years ago during a boar hunt.
Okay.
Auerbach calls this style fully foregrounded. Everything is illuminated, external, sensory, stable. There's no hint of psychological depth, no unspoken thoughts. It's all right there on the surface, crystal clear.
Like a brightly lit stage, you see every single thing.
Exactly. Then he contrasts this immediately with the biblical story of Abraham and Isaac, Genesis 22, the binding of Isaac.
And that's completely different.
The total opposite. The narrative is stark, incredibly tense, full of suspense. Auerbach says it's fraught with background.
Fraught with background. What does that mean exactly?
It means almost everything important is unsaid. We're told nothing about Abraham's inner turmoil, his feelings, Isaac's fear. The locations are vague. God's command is just there.
So all the huge psychological and theological depths are just left hanging, implied.
Yes. Left for the reader to interpret, to grapple with, to fill in the silence. It demands interpretation.
Wow. So that's the core contrast. Homeric style, clear, stable, external, versus the biblical style, psychologically complex, historically dynamic, full of unspoken layers.
That's the foundational dichotomy he builds on.
And it makes you think, doesn't it? When you read a news report today or watch a movie, is it giving you everything up front, Homer style? Or is it leaving gaps, hinting at things, making you do the work, like the Bible passage? That choice is still happening everywhere.
Absolutely. Which leads us right into the next big shift. The Christian Revolution, and this mixture of styles.
Right, we touched on this. The New Testament stories, especially about Jesus, just blew up the old rules.
They did, because the highest subject, the divine, was shown through the lowest elements, humble birth, suffering, execution. This sublime yet lowly mixture, as Auerbach calls it.
Became a new model for tragic realism, showing that profound meaning exists in the everyday, even the painful everyday.
Exactly, and Christianity also brought in this other key idea, figural interpretation.
Figural interpretation. Okay, that sounds important, but maybe a bit complex.
It can seem that way, but the core idea is about seeing history as having layers of meaning, all part of a divine plan.
Okay.
So in figural thinking, an event in the Old Testament that's the figure is seen as a real historical thing that happened.
Like Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt.
Right. But it also prefigures or points towards a later, more significant event in the New Testament, the fulfillment.
So Moses leading people from slavery in Egypt prefigures.
Christ leading humanity from the slavery of sin.
Exactly.
It connects events across time, imbuing history itself with this deep providential meaning.
So history isn't just one thing after another. It's a story with foreshadowing and fulfillment.
Wow. And this whole way of thinking, this mixture of styles, it all comes together brilliantly in Dante's Divine Comedy. Auerbach gives it a whole chapter.
Dante, right. He's seen as pulling together the classical and Christian worlds.
He is. And in the Inferno, Auerbach points out, Dante deliberately breaks the classical separation of styles. He puts real people from his own time.
Yeah, politicians, poets, popes he knew.
Right into hell. And subjects them to ultimate eternal judgment.
Imagine being Dante's neighbor. Well, look, Guido's down in the eighth circle this week.
Exactly. But the key is, he renders their earthly personalities, their political passions, their human flaws, with terrifying realism and treats them with the utmost tragic seriousness, no matter their social standing. That was revolutionary.
A huge step away from only treating kings and myths seriously.
A massive step. Okay, so from Dante, we jump forward to the Renaissance and this idea of the everyday gaining serious weight. It really accelerates, especially with someone like Shakespeare.
Ah, Shakespeare, yes. Plays like Hamlet. He's a master at blending everything, isn't he?
Totally. Tragic and comic, noble characters and, you know, common folk. Beautiful poetry and gritty prose. Sometimes all on the same scene or even the same character.
Like the gravedigger's scene in Hamlet. deeply philosophical, kind of morbidly funny, and it's just ordinary guys digging a grave. Kings and clowns really do share the stage and a common humanity.
It shows a much more complex, less rigidly layered view of the world. And then Auerbach takes us to Cervantes. Don Quixote, another crucial step.
Right, Don Quixote. How does that fit into this move towards modern realism?
Auerbach sees it as presenting this constantly shifting, multi-layered reality. You have Don Quixote's, well, mad idealism.
Living in his books of chivalry.
Clashing directly with Sancho Panza's very earthy, pragmatic, sensory view of the world.
The windmills versus the giants.
Exactly. And the setting for this clash is the everyday world. Dusty roads, inns, ordinary people. It becomes the stage for this amazing, tragicomic exploration of illusion versus truth. Reality isn't just one thing anymore. It's layered, debated, seen differently by different people.
Okay, so the ground is really being prepared. Which brings us to the 19th century novelists. Stendhal, Balzac, Flaubert. This is where modern realism really takes off.
This is the birthplace of what Auerbach calls modern historical realism. These novelists, he argues, were the first to truly embed their characters, think Julian Sorel in The Red and the Black, or everyone in Balzac's Pere Goriot.
Right, complex individuals.
Embed them fully within the concrete, dynamic reality of their specific historical moment, their society.
So it's not just about their personality, but how their lives, their ambitions, their fates are shaped by the world around them. Economics, politics, social class.
Precisely. Individual destiny is shown to be completely intertwined with these larger historical forces. And the average person's life, their struggles, their desires are treated with profound seriousness, no longer just comic relief.
And Flaubert with Madame Bovary.
Flaubert perfects this, Auerbach says, using this objective, almost impersonal style to dissect the tragic mediocrity of bourgeois life. Mm. The connection between Emma Bovary's inner desires and the limitations of her social reality is laid bare.
It's so true. When you watch a good historical drama today, or a show about, say, politics or business, you see that, don't you? How the characters are products of their time and place. That's this modern realism in action.
Absolutely. It's become almost second nature to us now. But Auerbach shows us how revolutionary it was. Okay, so as we move into the 20th century, there's another big turn.
A turn inward.
Exactly. The era of modernism. Subjective reality takes center stage.
And the key example here is Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse.
Right. Auerbach sees modernism, exemplified by Woolf, as this major shift away from depicting external, objective reality.
Towards the internal, subjective world of consciousness. This is where we get stream of consciousness.
That's the technique. Reality is filtered through the characters' minds. It's fragmented, associative. Thoughts drift. Big philosophical insights might be triggered by something tiny and everyday.
Like the brown stocking that Mrs. Ramsay's knitting in. To the lighthouse.
Exactly. That small detail becomes the anchor for a whole flow of thoughts and feelings. So what happens is a kind of dissolution of a single shared objective reality.
Replaced by multiple perspectives.
Multiple, simultaneous, often conflicting subjective realities. The inner landscape, the flow of thought and sensation becomes the primary reality being represented.
It's such a huge arc. From Homer's clear external world to Woolf's fragmented internal one. So let's try to boil this down. What are the biggest takeaways from Auerbach's incredible journey through mimesis?
Well, one absolutely central theme is what you could call the democratization of literature.
Right, the expansion.
Yeah, this progressive expansion of who gets treated seriously in literature, moving from just kings and epic heroes to include, you know, the middle class, the servant, the ordinary person. Alienated intellectual, everyone gets a seat at the serious literature table.
And tied to that is the idea that literary styles aren't just like window dressing. They're not just aesthetic choices.
Not at all. They actually express a culture's whole way of understanding the world. Changes in style reflect really deep changes in human consciousness, in how we perceive reality itself.
And that core contrast he started with never really goes away, does it? The Homeric versus the biblical.
That duality of foreground versus background echoes throughout. The choice between illuminating everything clearly, making it easy for the reader.
Versus suggesting unspoken depths, leaving gaps, making the reader work, interpret, engage more actively. That choice shapes how we experience any story.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, what you call the rise of interiority, that long, slow journey towards being able to represent the complexity of our inner lives, our subjective experiences, culminating in modernism, but really starting much earlier.
Absolutely. And remember, these aren't just dusty academic ideas. These are active forces. They shape the news you read, the movies you watch, the way politicians speak, the way ads try to persuade you. They influence how you understand yourself and the world. Every single day.
Mimesis must be full of memorable lines that capture these ideas.
Oh, it is. Though maybe key ideas is better than quotes, since he wrote it in German and working from translations and summaries, but the core concepts are powerful.
Okay, give us a few key ideas.
Well, maybe the most fundamental is this. The everyday life of man is worthy of tragic and problematic representation.
That really sums up the democratization point, doesn't it? Every life has weight. Every story matters, not just the grand ones.
Exactly. It's a profound statement about human dignity finding its place in literature. Then there's that core tension, fully externalized clarity versus psychologically pregnant depth.
The Homeric versus the biblical again, laid out clearly or full of hidden meaning.
Right. It's a fundamental choice in how you tell any story. And flowing from that historical journey is the idea that reality is not static. It is perceived and represented differently across history.
Ah, that's crucial. Our idea of what's realistic isn't fixed. It's shaped by our time, our culture.
Deeply. Which leads to another key insight. Literature actively shapes, rather than just reflects, our understanding of the human condition.
It's not just a mirror, it's also a lamp. It changes how we see.
Exactly. It's a two-way street. How we tell stories actually changes who we are and how we understand ourselves.
Okay, so this is fascinating history, but how can we actually use these ideas? You said it's a toolkit.
Yeah.
How does it apply in real life?
Well, for starters, it gives you enhanced media literacy, seriously. You can use Auerbach's framework, Homeric versus Biblical, high style versus low style, foreground versus background, to analyze any story.
Like a movie, a TV show, even a news article.
Absolutely. Is it giving you all the answers nice and clear? Or is it complex, maybe ambiguous, asking you to think? Does it treat its subjects seriously, even if they're ordinary people? Think about a show like, say, The Wire.
Oh, great example.
It's like a masterclass in Auerbachian realism, isn't it? It mixes high-stakes drama with mundane detail, treats cops, criminals, politicians, kids, all with tragic weight, embedding them completely in their socioeconomic reality.
Yeah, it refuses easy answers. It's definitely fraught with background. Okay, what else?
It can help in developing empathy and breaking down hierarchies. Understanding how storytelling slowly learned to see the profound in lives previously considered, well, insignificant.
It encourages us to do the same, to look for depth and seriousness in people around us, regardless of their job or status.
Exactly. And maybe to be more critical of stories that rely on easy stereotypes or simplistic portrayals.
That makes sense. And you mentioned it's useful for communicators, too.
Definitely. It's a toolkit for storytellers and communicators. Even just thinking about foreground versus background can help you decide how much do I need to spell out, how much can I trust my audience to infer,
right.
And mixing the high, maybe the big vision, the abstract idea with the low, a specific, relatable detail, a human story that makes communication much more powerful, whether you're in marketing, leadership, teaching, even just talking to friends.
Connecting the big picture with the concrete example.
Yeah. And finally, maybe the broadest application. It gives us a deeper understanding of history, recognizing that our own perception of reality is historically constructed, just like previous eras.
It helps us question our own assumptions about what's normal or realistic.
It does. And to appreciate that future generations might look back at our way of seeing the world as just as specific, maybe even strange, as the Homeric worldview seems to us now.
Wow. This has been incredibly rich. So much to think about from just one book, albeit a massive one. What stands out most for you wrapping up on Auerbach's Mimesis?
For me, honestly, it's the sheer resilience behind it. The act of writing this vast, deeply humane, deeply learned book while in exile, largely from memory, during one of history's darkest times. It's just staggering.
Yeah.
It's a powerful reminder that literature, history, humanistic thought, they aren't just academic games. They're essential for understanding ourselves, for preserving what matters.
I think what strikes me most is how it makes you see that every story, consciously or not, makes choices about how it represents reality. And those choices tell you so much. It makes me want to reread, rewatch everything with this new filter.
That's the power of it. The most valuable lesson, maybe, is that realism isn't some fixed destination we've arrived at. It's this dynamic, ongoing, centuries-long struggle to represent the sheer complexity of human life more faithfully, more inclusively.
And Mimesis itself, written during that global conflict.
Yeah.
It really stands as this testament to literature's power to preserve, to question, and ultimately to deepen our shared sense of humanity.
Beautifully put. So maybe the final thought for you, the listener. When you next encounter a story, could be an ancient myth, a new novel, a film, even just a post on social media, ask yourself, what kind of reality is this trying to show me? And what does that choice tell me about the world it came from? And maybe, just maybe, about my own.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by eCotra Foundation.